Well, Jefferson is forced with a horrible crisis here, a horrible nightmare, in fact. In order to remain optimistic, to retain his composure, he must, as it were, intellectually look away. And this, I think, is a source of his perennial optimism, an optimism based on need, on the impossibility of facing certain stark realities squarely. As he writes, it is impossible to be temperate and to pursue this subject through the various considerations of policy, of morals, of history, natural and civil. We must be contented to hope they will force their way into everyone's mind. And here comes that booming optimism. I think a change already perceptible since the origin of the present revolution. So on the one hand, he's a vocal opponent of slavery. On the other, Jefferson is not just a racist, he's a pretty vitriolic racist. He argues that blacks are inferior in intellect, in imagination, in sensibility. They're incapable of either scientific analysis, artistic creation, or civic virtue. Moreover, there are a series of rather disturbing sexual fears in his writing about the dangers of miscegenation and intermixture, which raise interesting questions not only about his future relationship with Sally Hemings, but about what is a clear reality throughout Southern plantation society. And I want to read an extended bit on what he says about African Americans, because I think it's extremely important. He begins by looking for the foundation of the differences, and he begins with physical appearance and color. Is it, color, not the foundation of a greater or less share of beauty in the two races? After all, whites can blanch, they can blush, they can show a variety of different expressions. He describes the black face as eternal monotony. Add to these flowing hair, a more elegant symmetry of form, their own judgment in favor of the whites, declared by their preference of them, as uniformly as is the preference of the Uranitan for the black women over those of his own species. And Jefferson is clearly raising a major canard here. He's afraid of the desire of black men for white women. More than that, he analogizes that to the orangutan, which is what he means by orangutan, and its sexual desire for African women. Now, by the way, it is worth noting that had he said this in the 17th century, it would have been credible. Travel narratives telling of such amatory interspecies engagements were not uncommon. But by the 18th century, Jefferson knows this isn't true. He's trying to convince himself. Well, what are the other differences? Well, they have a very strong and disagreeable odor. No doubt a result of the fact that their kidneys don't work as well as us. It never occurs to Jefferson that they don't only have one change of clothing and aren't given many opportunities to wash. They seem to require less sleep. A black, after hard labor through the day, will be induced by the slightest amusements to sit up till midnight or later, though knowing he must be out with the first dawn of the morning. Of course, Jefferson is ignoring the reality that this is the only time slaves have to themselves to create a community and to spend time with their families. They are more ardent after their female, but love seems with them to be an eager desire, more so than a tender, delicate mixture of sentiment and sensation. So there's a sense of animality to them. Their griefs are transient, those numberless afflictions which render it doubtful whether human has given life to us, heaven has given life to us in mercy or in wrath, are less felt and sooner forgotten with them. In general, their existence appears to participate more of sensation than reflection. So there's a combination here. He sees African Americans as both childlike and as bestial. In memory, they're equal to the whites. In reason, much inferior, as I think one could scarcely be found capable of tracing and comprehending the investigations of Euclid. And in fact, when he does meet one or learns of one, Benjamin Banneker, he's extremely skeptical about whether Mr. Banneker actually does the mathematics in his own almanac. In imagination, they are dull, tasteless, and anomalous. Now, many historians have tried to defend Jefferson here because, unlike 20th century people, he didn't know the distinction between culture and nature, between race and simply the milieu in which one lives. But that won't wash with Jefferson, because Jefferson specifically defends the American Indian on the ground that he did not have the rich cultural inheritance of his white competitors, and therefore you have to take that into account. The Indians, with no advantage of this kind, will often carve figures on their pipes, not destitute of design and merit. They will crayon out an animal, a plant, or a country, so as to prove the existence of a germ in their minds which only wants cultivation. But never yet could I find that a black had uttered a thought above the level of plain narration. Never see even an elementary trait of painting or sculpture. Now, Jefferson knows better. There are famous black poets of the time, most famous Phyllis Wheatley. But Jefferson wants to defend against that. Misery is often the parent of the most affecting touches in poetry. Among the blacks is misery enough, God knows, but no poetry. Religion indeed has produced a Phyllis Wheatley, but it could not produce a poet. The compositions published under her name are below the dignity of criticism.